This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Homes being built today feature lots of closets, big closets, lots of storage space for clothing, shoes, accessories, linens, and more. But not long ago, most people didn't need those closets. They had very few clothes. Clothing was expensive, often made at home, often handed down, or purchased secondhand. Fashion, it was for the wealthy. When did that begin to change? Why? And what did the availability of more reasonably priced clothing mean for Americans and for the country? Historian Jenna Weissman-Joslett examines the meaning of clothes for the working and middle classes in her new book, A Perfect Fit, Clothes, Character, and the Promise of America. She looks at the period when ready-to-wear came into its own, the years from 1890 to 1940. She says ready-to-wear helped Americans of every faith, color, and class to feel part of a unified modern nation. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest this afternoon. Join the discussion with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, our number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Jenna Weissman-Joslett teaches American Studies at Princeton and Yale Universities. A Perfect Fit is her fifth book. Her previous books include The Wonders of America, Reinventing Jewish Culture, 1880 to 1950. It won the National Jewish Book Award in History. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Jenna Joslett, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
You say clothing at this time in history, 1890 to 1940, was so much about fitting in, more about fitting in than sticking out. And isn't clothing still largely about fitting in?
Sure, but I think back then clothing was much more about fitting in as Americans. Now, these days, it's about fitting into a particular group. So that the compass, the moral compass of fashion or of clothing has shrunk greatly over the intervening 50 or 60 years. Mm. And earlier, I think, when Americans got dressed, they wanted to dress like an American, whatever that means. And so there was a sense of belonging to something larger than one's individual community or racial background or ethnic group.
Yeah. What did it mean to dress like an American?
Well, for one thing, you could change your clothing at will. With the rise of ready-to-wear, one had at one's fingertips almost just a remarkable treasure trove of different styles at relatively affordable prices. And as you said in your intro, before the rise of ready-to-wear, clothing was extraordinarily dear. People didn't have very much by way of clothing. And here, with the triumph of mass-produced clothing, people could afford to buy lots of different things and to change their looks depending on the size of their pocketbook.
Mm-hmm. And here we have the idea of the self-made man or woman and make you the possibility of making yourself over and over again.
Right, and you know, we tend to forget that. But what a wonderful challenge. And it gave, I think, particularly those on the margins, a sense of America's promise and even its bounty. Mm. So I think that the clothing back then had far more of a transformative, a magical impact. One of the sources I came across actually went so far as to call clothing Cinderella clothes.
Mm. One of the very interesting things you write about is the great number of authorities on clothing.
Yep.
You know, who, even though we supposedly could, you know, make ourselves over and be Cinderella, well, there were definitely rules about how to become Cinderella.
Yes, there were lots of rules. And people whom today we don't ordinarily associate with weighing in about matters sartorial had lots to say, so from school teachers to religious leaders. I found so many wonderful sermons about the importance of the proper hat or the proper set of gloves or, in the case of women, skirt lengths. And that was quite startling to find. That the clergy was so concerned with the physical dimensions of their congregations or their congregants' lives. And, of course, the usual run, you know, etiquette manuals, how-to books. Our generation these days is blessed with all of these books about how to transform yourself, but they're not new. And I think given the rise of ready-to-wear, which presented all sorts of both possibilities and challenges, there arose with it a huge outpouring of how-to literature.
Yeah. And even if it wasn't in literature, it was, you were surrounded by it. It came from, as you mentioned, the pulpit,
mm-hmm.
the press, community groups.
Right.
Groups like the 4-H.
Right.
Farm groups.
Mm-hmm.
Community groups.
Most suggestively, the front page of newspapers. Today, of course, fashion is often relegated or dismissed to the back pages or to the style section. But back then, in that wonderfully evocative period of American history, clothing was actually the subject of front page news. So a new hat, a new color, the ups and downs of women's hemlines, all of this occasioned, you know, sustained inquiry within the public media of the time.
Yeah. Now, it hasn't been that long ago that we saw some editorializing about, you know, lengths of
mm-hmm.
skirts. I mean, in the 60s, there was the miniskirt and that kind of thing. But it was fun and interesting to read about how newspapers might editorialize about the size of hats.
Isn't that amazing? Yes, such a delicious find. I should say, too, that it was a joy to write this book. It took me 5 years. But it was such a joy to stumble, and that's what historians often do. We just stumble across these wonderful treasure troves of information, and there, lo and behold, in the New York Times, you know, editorials weighing in about big hats and how they were not good for one's health, or how they made life in urban areas particularly perilous because their size was so big, or to find church leaders inveighing against the size of big hats because they obstructed the view of congregants who had to sit in the back of the church. So wonderful details like this suggest the power and the resonance of clothing for an earlier generation.
As you worked on this book, did you find yourself looking into your own closet?
No, not so much that. I wished I lived in the 1920s. In fact, I styled my hair to look like a flapper. I really caught into clothing from the 1920s. And the other thing I did was to try on lots of clothing. So I would frequent different flea markets in my neighborhood and have the opportunity to try on some old hats and some old dresses and corsets, which were not fun to wear. And so that gave me, it didn't give me a sense of the parameters of my closet, but gave me a sense of what my closet might have looked like if I had come of age in the 1920s.
So what's it like wearing a corset?
Not fun. Not fun. And it's, what they say is true. It does change your posture. It changes your demeanor. Sometimes in a very positive way, it made me stand up straighter. But I couldn't move as fast as I do in ordinary uncorseted circumstances. And it just made me much more still and centered.
Yeah.
And so what they say about the corsets is absolutely true. And the same thing with hats. I tried on all sorts of wonderful cloche hats from the 1920s, and they, too, very dramatically affected my posture and my way of walking.
Well, that's interesting, because I would think that that type of hat wouldn't be as near as troublesome, if you will,
mm-hmm.
as the big hats that were worn at the turn of the century.
They weren't as cumbersome, but they do constrict the head, and they come down to part of the neck, and so you can't move your neck as freely. I don't know, you hold your head higher, you just move differently in them. That was fun.
Mm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's talk with a caller in Taylorville on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. I was just thinking of the enormous disparity between what women's fashion looked like up until the late teens of the last century and what started happening in the 20s and how much the media, particularly Hollywood, had to do with it. Remembering, for example, the business with Jane Harlow in that movie, redheaded woman, she's in this dress shop and asks the sales girl about a particular skirt, can you see through this? And she says, I'm afraid you can, ma'am. And the Harlow babe says, good, I'll take it. comparing the technologies and the way the technology, of course, accentuated all these new directions in fashions with the sort of technology which was much more an individual one back in the 19th century, and focusing on the the hoop skirt phenomenon, and corsets, which so many women wore, which, needless to say, were specifically intended not just to make the waist look thinner than it was, but what was rather above the waist to look rather more fulsome. And those incredible hoop skirts were under which I think if you were a proper Southern belle with a Yankee lover, you could hide maybe one or possibly two if they were Munchkin size. And that reminded me a couple of Munchkins, each of them going oochie coochie, oochie coochie. Perhaps, perhaps a discreet venue available wherein they can all get rather less inhibited.
Well, I'm gonna pause there and thank the caller for his call this afternoon. I'm sure any proper Southern belle would be horrified by such a suggestion. But it goes back to the issue that we were talking about before the flapper, before Flapper Jane, those corsets and all the clothes that a woman put on as she began her day were.
I mean, talk about troublesome and cumbersome. There was quite a lot, and apparently not terribly healthy too, because so many of these skirts reached the floor or the street, and would pick up whatever waste happened to be lurking on the street, and so women discovered, much to their chagrin, that some of their skirts were actually, as one scientist put it, septic. The skirts were poisonous; that they contained all manner of unsavory stuff, let alone being difficult and heavy to wear.
Yeah, and they were not easy to clean.
No, and we didn't have back then dry cleaning, so the laundry bills must have been enormous. And I suspect that most folks didn't change their clothes as frequently as we do today, because obviously standards of personal hygiene and cleanliness have ratcheted up dramatically over the years. So, in addition to everything else, the skirt would be soiled for long periods of time. So, yes, I think we're better off.
It's interesting to me how the suffrage movement or women's emancipation hooked up, if you will, with domestic science.
Right. And you see that in many ways, particularly in my case, in terms of skirts, that very progressive-minded women were all in favor of progressive skirts because they felt that they were not only more hygienically sound, but that they literally freed women to move about more quickly, to embrace modernity, to have a life that was not being encumbered by these weighty skirts. In fact, in the towards the tail end of the 1920s, early 1930s, when fashion designers began to argue for the return of the long skirt, emancipated women said, "Not on your life." Were absolutely determined to cling to the short skirt because they felt that the shorter skirt spelled their physical and cultural emancipation.
Did women at that time, other than those who were wearing bloomers, were pants ever a consideration?
No, pants were completely off limit, and that is one of the legacies of World War II, that inasmuch as women now went to work in factories and had to don long pants for safety purposes, that pants, or slacks as they were called, to differentiate them from men's trousers, little by little began to make their way into the dress vocabulary. So it's really not until the 1950s that slacks increasingly become more of an accepted part of women's wardrobe. And even then, there's a great deal of apprehension, to the point that Vogue magazine had to issue what it called a primer, in which it encouraged women to take up the wearing of pants and showed them how to wear them, with what, because pants seem to be such a taboo. I don't know about you, but I wear pants all the time these days.
I do, too.
Yeah, so I can't imagine my life without them. But, it didn't grow out of some fashion dictate. Instead, it grew out of a grassroots response to working women during the war.
Yeah. On the other hand, on a very warm summer day, there's nothing like a linen skirt.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. I guess that's really taboo for men, isn't it, to wear something that would be so So perceived to be such a woman's, that's a mm-hmm, woman's garment.
Although, you know, there too there are some historical parallels, so that in the 1920s there was this big dress reform movement for men. Most folks don't know about it, in which men were encouraged to don lightweight clothing and to wear more loosely fitted jackets and trousers and to wear color. And the color aspect of things, I think, gained a toehold in American culture by the 1930s, but certainly not the loose linen trousers that would come much later.
Mm. So the clothing men wore also was lightening up, loosening up,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't really have an impact on the male identity as
no,
it had.
No, I don't
had.
Think so. I don't think it transformed or emancipated men in much the same way that a short skirt or a flapper dress and that very loose, boyish silhouette completely redefined the nature of womanliness and even prettiness. That didn't happen for men.
That's really interesting, the issue of prettiness.
Yeah.
You write in the book, at least since the mid-19th century, prettiness was celebrated as a woman's birthright,
mm-hmm.
even her duty. And then you quote someone by the name of C.H. Crandall,
mm-hmm.
writing on women's fashions, "Prettiness is that flowing outline that shall proclaim at once the sweetness and preciousness of womanhood."
Mm-hmm.
And but that kind of prettiness, womanliness, as we've alluded to earlier in this interview, was a real pain in the neck.
Right, and came at quite a cost, both physically and psychically. I think what the Flapper Janes of the world did was to sunder prettiness from womanliness and to offer up a wide variety of notions of womanliness, not just a monopoly or just the hegemony of prettiness, that one could be a woman and needn't be quite as precious or as contained or as ornamental as Mr. Crandall would have it.
Mm. Tell us about the Rainy Daisies.
Rainy Daisy was a wonderful group of women who decided to shorten their skirts in what was then thought to be a scandalously short length. It was 4 inches above the ankle. And the reason they did this is because they rejected the idea of wearing long skirts in the rain because they'd catch cold or the skirts would be dirty. It would be very unpleasant. So they simply hiked up their skirts 4 inches, and that caused a huge outcry. And the Rainy Daisies, somebody called them the Rainy Daisies, and that that appellation stuck. But in a sense, they were as much avid social reformers as the suffragettes or the domestic scientists at the time. And they spearheaded what ultimately became a major revolution in women's dress, which was leading all the way to the short skirt. And even the short skirt of the 1920s, when we think about it, is mid-calf. Or maybe it's a little bit above the knee. It's nothing like the miniskirt of the 60s.
Yeah. Women could move then with those shorter skirts,
mm-hmm.
and with the corsets tossed
unleashed.
Aside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, to what extent was that mobility celebrated, and to what extent was it condemned? Because let's go back to this idea of all these authorities out there
mm-hmm.
telling us, you know, or telling the women and men of the time, well, this is proper and this is improper.
Right, right.
You've got this huge change underway.
Mm-hmm.
So who was saying hooray and who was saying mm-mm-mm?
Well, hooray were largely younger women and people in the fashion industry. And the men folk who were encouraging of progressive women, they all welcomed the shorter skirt and the loosening of the corset. But there were an equally powerful group of voices arrayed against who argued in such poetic language for the return of the elusive ankle and who believed that the femininity of America was being undone, or that women were being, as they would put it, unsexed by wearing short skirts. And they lobbied very hard for a return to longer skirts. And those women tended to be more conservative, more well-heeled, more fearful of social change. And very often, those women, including one of the characters in my book, a Mrs. Henderson of Washington, D.C., a member of the DAR, felt that short skirts reflected the growing prominence of those on the margins in American society, meaning American Jews and African Americans, and who took to the short skirts with great passion. And she was not pleased.
Yeah. How important was dress in the African American community and in the immigrant community?
I think it was pivotal, absolutely key. And it was one of the few things that allowed both immigrants and African Americans to believe that the promise of America was in reach if only they dressed the part. So that while ready-to-wear was important for everybody in America, I think it bore a special charge for immigrants, because if they could just dress right, dress like a lady or a gentleman, put on the right hat or a starched white shirt, perhaps those who were at the center rather than the margins would treat them better.
Hmm. They would be on their way, and they would be, I think dignity is
dignity,
is very
dignity,
much important.
Dignity, yes, and the idea that gentlemanliness was not the sole purchase of the upper classes, but that the idea that gentlemanliness or womanliness would be in reach for the children of African American slaves was such a powerful and poignant idea, to the point where race leaders too created all sorts of guidebooks. One of the most poignant being a book called The Negro in Etiquette, a novelty, which was written in 1899, and which spent a great deal of time counseling newly emancipated African Americans on how to dress like a proper gent and how to avoid looking like, as one text puts it, looking like a dude.
Hmm. Across America, rural, urban settings, the fashion show was very important and very popular.
Mm-hmm.
When did the fashion show begin in the United States, and what did it give folks?
Well, I don't know when it began. That's a really good question. Perhaps one of your listeners might know the answer to that. But again, beginning with the rise of ready-to-wear, department stores would put on all sorts of fashion shows, and then it would trickle down the social spectrum so that little ladies' shops in Niles, California would put on fashion shows, and then it would make its way even further down the social ladder to the point where 4-H clubs and high school groups and, of course, women's organizations of all sorts began to institute fashion shows as a regular matter of social and cultural programming. What did it all mean? I think it was a way of introducing clothing foursquare into the daily life of women, and of suggesting that clothing was not a burden, that clothing was not something that should be cumbersome and arduous, but that clothing could be a form of theatricality and a way of celebrating the self.
Would you share with us, I don't know if you have the book in front of you, but The Pledge?
No, isn't that wonderful?
That
the
is wonderful.
The Pledge, yes.
The Pledge. I think it's in the introduction. Let me reintroduce you as you look for that. Jenna Wiseman-Joslett is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of A Perfect Fit, Clothes, Character, and the Promise of America. The book looks at the period when ready-to-wear came into its own in the United States, the years from 1890 to 1940. Joslett says ready-to-wear helped Americans of every faith, color, and class to feel part of a unified modern nation. She says we dressed to look American. Listeners, your questions and comments are encouraged, invited. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. Our number is 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL. Anywhere else, 800-222-WILL. Did you find the pledge?
I sure did. And it's, I guess, the sartorial equivalent of the Pledge of Allegiance, and it goes like this. As an American woman, I pledge myself to strive always to acquire and wear only such clothes as are appropriate and individual becoming. I pledge myself to avoid extremes in design and color, to respect my clothes enough to care for them to the very best of my ability, and I pledge to select my clothes so that, in fairness to them, they may give back to me in service more than they cost me in money. Amen, do we say?
I suppose that holds up pretty well.
It does, but it is kind of hilarious. And the idea that women had to stop for a second and think about what it is they were about to do when they embarked on a shopping expedition is to me quite delicious.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how long it was before, you know, how suddenly ready-to-wear showed up in department stores and in even, you know, in little shops mm-hmm. throughout the country. I mean, did we go from a period of time where people were making clothes in their own homes and or going to a seamstress or a tailor?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how quickly did that change? Was there suddenly retailers selling ready to wear?
Well, there had been retailers who were selling all manner of dry goods, including bolts of fabric and hooks and eyes and things necessary to make clothing. I think that the transition was a gradual one. Obviously, Patterns and McCall's and Mademoiselle and even Vogue maintained a stock of patterns. Didn't fall from grace. And sewing remained a very important aspect of American women's culture. But I think little by little, certainly by the 1920s, more folks bought their clothes than made them.
Let's talk with another listener. On line one, a caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was wondering if you could comment on the reason why men's business suits seem to have changed little over the period that you're talking about, whereas women's fashions have gone from the everywhere up to the micro mini and the see-through blouse, and I wonder what those men who were faced with seeing a woman's ankle in public for the first time were expected to do, look at their shoes.
Avert their gaze, I
think.
Thank you. You ask a very good question, and that is why did female fashion seem to change with great alacrity, and men's fashions, in contrast, remain really stable? And that was a question that plagued viewers and listeners and readers back in the 1920s, too. In fact, there was a very famous journalist named Frederick Lewis Allen, who wanted to know why it is in 1926 that nobody ever writes about men's clothes. And the reason was, as he explained, is that there wasn't much to say that men's clothes stayed remarkably stable once the suit was instituted as the basic unit. And I think that has to do with the power of the idea of gentlemanliness, that there weren't too many changes or alterations to that ideal, and the visual form that that ideal of gentlemanliness took was the idea of a very somber, dark colored suit, not terribly fitted. It didn't hug the body, it just sort of encompassed the body, and a starched white shirt. And that ideal remained intact with a couple of knocks here and there way into the 1960s.
Also, you know, it was seen as unmanly to express any kind of concern about what one looked like.
Right. Right, and where fashion was seen historically as women's province, men's clothing was seen as something that a man simply had to reckon with but shouldn't really be fretting over or thinking about, even though obviously lots of men did. And there, too, there were tons of guidebooks that helped to guide men through the shoals of men's fashions, but it was not seen as a congenial, manly topic. And the same held true for jewelry. Men were told to stay clear of jewelry. In fact, one guidebook indicated that the best thing that a man could do with a diamond is to deck his wife with one, but not for him to wear it at all. So the idea of any kind of ornamentation or color or flamboyance was essentially anathemized in American culture up until the 1960s.
But men were very much concerned about how they looked, even though they might not want to talk about
it. Right.
They were worried about it.
They were worried, and I think ready-to-wear also introduced some changes, not as dramatic as women's clothing, but changes in fabric and in color, and, of course, in the area of accessories like a brightly patterned tie or a brightly patterned pair of socks. But as I say, it didn't change the general silhouette of the man, which was designed to be somber, restrained, quiet, to bespeak a certain amount of authority, where women's clothes was thought to bespeak a certain amount of frivolity or whimsy.
Yeah. Hats were important for men, and here's an area where they could shine, so to speak, in terms of fashion.
Right. Because they had a variety of options. In the summer, they could put on a straw hat, and the straw hats came in different sizes, had different color bands, were a little bit more flamboyant than the ordinary fedora or derby. But even outside the precincts of the derby or the fedora or the straw hat, men could put on a cap. I mean, there were more vehicles, more forms of headgear for men than there were forms of shoes or forms of suits. So I think there was a little bit more latitude in play for men. As you say, men could shine at the top of their heads.
And also that hat offered them an opportunity for a for a little playfulness or a little flash, and how they removed it and how they introduced themselves.
Exactly. And there, too, though, there were all sorts of rules defining the limit and the quotient of playfulness. And I find so interesting in American culture that tension between the desire to be playful and colorful and the desire to harness playfulness and color to some larger social end.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon. Do we have a caller there on line one? No, maybe they'll call us back. 333-9455 is the number to call in Champaign-Urbana. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, excuse me, is Jenna Weissman-Joslett. We're talking with her about her book, A Perfect Fit, Close Character and the Promise of America. Jenna Joslett is a historian. She teaches American studies at Princeton and Yale universities. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. The changes that were happening in the U.S. with the rise of ready-to-wear, were they also taking place in Europe?
Very good question. I would say not to the same degree. One, of course, does... There is, of course, a burgeoning ready-to-wear industry, particularly in Paris, at the same time as the ready-to-wear industry is developing in this country. But it doesn't take hold in quite the same way, and it also does not have as much to do with national character as it does in America, where ready-to-wear is truly seen as an expression of American democracy and American plenitude. And that argument or that rhetoric is not associated with the rise of ready-to-wear in, say, Paris.
Mm, very interesting. And advertising at this time, is it changing? It seems to me, but I could be totally wrong about this, that because the importance of clothes and the issue of fashion is becoming a big issue and is becoming important to people, that advertisers are doing their share to sell products, well, not only to sell clothing, but to sell other things. And as they're selling these other products, whether it be a car or a home or whatever, there are people in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And they are dressed in a certain manner.
Right.
And I wonder if advertising is changing at this point from where advertisers are selling a product to where they're selling what we would now call a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. I think that you said it very well, Celeste. And one of the devices that advertisements use to get at this broader social change are pictures or drawings or wonderful illustrations. And so that when one is buying a product, one sees the average American who's leafing through, say, Vogue or Redbook, is not just seeing words and some kind of intellectual notion of a product, but they're seeing a visual universe open before them. And I think advertisements are key. And they, too, go hand-in-hand with the burgeoning American economy and the what Lewis Mumford called the goods life, so that advertisements very much further our preoccupation with the goods life, and they make it real and tangible.
Let's talk with another listener on a cell phone on line one. Hi.
Hi. I hope you can hear me. Very interesting discussion, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. But
Thank
I do
you.
Want to raise one small issue with something the author said a little earlier when she talked about the hoop skirts and keeping them clean. We have to remember that before the Civil War, many of those women had slaves to wash clothes for them. So I don't think it would have cost them as much as she suggested. Now, after slavery, I think they would have had to pay a minimum wage or some small amount of money to black women and white immigrant women to keep those big, you know, skirts and dresses clean. But I wondered if in your book you factor in the labor issue and clothing and who's making it and who's keeping them clean and that sort of thing.
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good point. I do in the book talk about the disproportionately large number of immigrants who are making all this wonderful clothing. And, of course, there the great irony is that the folks who are basically dressing America are recently arrived immigrants who are involved in the jewelry, the millinery, and the garment trades. And I think that that's such a wonderful comment about the complexity of American culture, that it's largely immigrant and minority labor that is dressing the rest of the country.
Yeah. So at this point where ready-to-wear is becoming available for many Americans, for many others, they're still either making their own clothing or they're buying it secondhand.
Right.
How common were secondhand clothing stores?
I think they were probably as common as the pawn shop or as the corner grocery store. But they were not seen as redoubtable public institutions like they are today. I mean, today everybody speaks very proudly of shopping in a vintage store. Of course, today they're called vintage, not secondhand stores. Giving them a certain patina that they otherwise lacked. But they were enormously popular, particularly in poor neighborhoods where people did not have the resources to buy and change their clothing as frequently as they would like. So they had recourse to the secondhand store, which was an extremely popular outlet. And then what's really fascinating to me is that the number of women's philanthropic groups who began to adopt the secondhand store as a form of charitable endeavor. And so what they do is basically to transform what might have been a marginal and slightly seedy operation into something that had the earmarks of highfalutin women's charity. But the function remains the same, and that is to provide folks with limited resources with clothing that looked pretty good.
Yeah. I would imagine a number of our listeners this afternoon had the experience as children of having something handed down.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that happens as much today as it did even just a generation ago.
I wouldn't know, because so much of children's clothing today is fairly affordable. But I imagine, that would be a wonderful thing to research, the ongoing role of hand-me-downs.
Also, fashion has become quite important to children.
Yes, and that's a brand-new development. I don't know exactly when to date that, but that wasn't the case in the 1890s through the 1940s. I mean, clearly there was clothing for children, but it didn't occupy the same cultural significance, let's say Gap for Kids or Baby Gap or Children's Place or any number of these huge chains do today.
Yeah.
And what that all means, I don't know. I'll leave that to subsequent generations of historians.
Well, it's just, it's another, it points out again the importance of clothing and what it says about us and our culture.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to the secondhand clothing stores, because this is very interesting, and maybe it's difficult for me to understand, is because we see secondhand clothing stores today as vintage or as a wonderful opportunity to get something, we couldn't afford. That still is operational,
right,
I think.
Right.
You can go to a secondhand store in a big city and you can buy something that someone has cast away that cost them a lot of money. And here, what I'm getting at is, back, years ago, those secondhand clothing stores, how often was there an opportunity to buy something that would be a magnificent piece of clothing that someone had worn maybe only a couple of times?
I don't know. That's one of those wonderful conundra that's so hard to figure out because, we're not in the historical past to ask people what they were doing. But what I do know, though, is that it wasn't the extraordinary outfit that that was accessible at the secondhand clothing shop, but regular bits of clothing. And I think your question reflects the difference in attitude that we have now to the secondhand or vintage shop, where we look for really great finds or, a terrific old handbag, maybe, an alligator handbag or a great couture dress that we never ever could afford, and now it's languishing on the shelves of a secondhand store. I think back then the clothing was more run-of-the-mill, more ordinary, and really reflected the exigencies of living in modern America, where money then as now was tight, and so people would be able to replenish or augment or add to their wardrobes, not simply find a one-in-a-kind kind of object.
Yeah, and as you point out in the book, if something went to the secondhand store, chances are it was well worn.
Mm-hmm.
And you point out somebody, I don't know if it was a tailor or someone, said that something in the secondhand store was worn, and so the original owner had made its mark, his or her mark, on that garment. So, you think about elbows and knees and cuffs and things. So when you got something that was secondhand, you were living with in
somebody else's body.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to pick up another point that you made about the popularity of secondhand clothing. I think that it was so popular, so much so that Fanny Brice could sing this song that became her signature song, which was Secondhand Rose.
Sure.
And in the song, she talks about how she has never had a thing that ain't been used. I've been wearing secondhand hats and secondhand clothes. That's why they call me Secondhand Rose. And that song was enormously popular, and I think it reflected the extent to which so many folks did have access to and familiarity with a secondhand shop. You know, it wasn't part of a singular shopping experience or a unique moment. It was essential to their domestic economy.
Yeah.
And it did come at some psychic cost, which was that the thing wasn't yours, that the previous wearer had left her imprint.
Yeah. That song was in Funny Girl, and Barbara Streisand sang it so wonderfully. And I remember the line, even Jake the Plumber.
Right.
He's the man I adore.
Mm-hmm.
He had the nerve to tell me he'd been married
before.
Let's talk with another listener on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I just had a question about secondhand furs. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, when I was a student at the University of Minnesota, it was very popular to go to furriers who had used furs, and these furs kept us all very warm. and then as people went away from the popularity of buying new furs diminished. You know, we were all very proud that we had worn our used furs, and I'm wondering if that's still popular today, or if it's still being done. I live in Champaign, so we don't have many occasions to wear furs. But I did when I was in Minneapolis. And could you just comment?
I do have a chapter in the book about fur, although I focus more on the popularity of unused furs in the 1920s. And one of the remarkable things is that in the 1920s, as in our own day, and that's something to which I think you were alluding, there were all sorts of anti-fur movements. There were a group of people known as the Fur Anties. A-N-T-I, apostrophe S, because they felt that wearing fur was just a moral blemish on the American character. It's not a view I happen to share, I hasten to say that. I'm a big fan of fur, but I think in the 1920s, when fur became increasingly affordable and popular, a growing segment of the population also began to question whether people who were wearing fur were somehow being untrue to America's national character. And that I found extremely interesting, that ongoing debate, which obviously, to mix my metaphors, had legs in the 1990s as well.
All right, interesting. I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. That brings us to the topic of furs. What about jewelry?
What about? Is it
well,
good?
Yes, it's a good thing, in moderation,
right.
Like everything else. But there was a time when jewelry was very understated, and then, you know,
Became more stated. Right. And that, too, like everything else having to do with clothing, also occasioned a great moral debate about whether the presence of so many gold-wearing women might not be a compromising position and might not suggest that Americans had lost their moral compass or their moral sense of self, and that they had given themselves over too completely to ostentation and excess. And this was a burning issue, particularly in the 1890s, which is also an example of the growing popularity of jewelry wearing and the growing affordability of jewelry, so that, you know, you always have this dance between the accessibility of the material and this ongoing moral question as to whether it's good for America's soul. And the 1890s in particular was a time which historians have dubbed the Gilded Age, and it was a time when all manner of ornamentation became increasingly popular and affordable. And so Americans wondered whether they were tarnishing their soul and the moral economy of this country by decking themselves out too much in gilded goodies.
Well, that's where we'll have to leave it, because we're out of time.
Okay.
Sorry to say. And we didn't even get to shoes.
No. Oh, my goodness.
That's a great chapter. People will have to look for the book.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon, Jenna.
It's been my pleasure.
Jenna Wiseman-Joslett has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's a historian. Her latest book is A Perfect Fit, Clothes, Character, and the Promise of America. It's published by Metropolitan Books.